I thank Sam Howell for continuing to provide beautiful music, and also Julia as well. That's one of my favorite hymns that was at my ordination, and just always gets me. I'm sure that it will come as no surprise when I tell you that I don't enjoy camping. People say to me, oh, if you would only get a better tent, or get a blow-up mattress, or spend thousands of dollars on better cooking equipment, then you'd really enjoy camping. But let's be honest. I have a better tent, a better mattress, and a kitchen at my house. And it's usually bug-free. And the last time I went camping as a child, my parents took the whole family to Big Sur on the Pacific coast, and it rained all night, and my mother and my three siblings slept in the car, and I slept in the toilet stall in the public bathroom. My attitude about the great outdoors is that I am willing to give up my spot so that the great outdoors will be less crowded. Or, as the comedian Jim Gaffigan said, everyone was homeless until we invented houses. So it is with this in mind that I admit that I struggle to appreciate the deep and mysterious meaning of the Israelites' founding story, the Passover and the Exodus, from their 400 years as slaves to the Egyptians. It was this miraculous watershed event that not only made the various Hebrews a nation, but it defined the true God for them and for the world. I am the God that brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. He was the one who was powerful enough to defeat the world's superpower, the Egyptians, and to provide for the Israelites in the desert on their long camping trip for 40 years. As the prophet Jeremiah reminded the people of Jerusalem who their God was, in the words, "The Lord who brought us up from the land of Egypt, who led us in the wilderness, in a land of deserts and pits, in a land of drought and deep darkness, in a land that none passes through, where no man dwells. This is your God. And I brought you into a plentiful land," says Jeremiah, "to enjoy its fruits and its good things." The true God shows himself to be true and faithful to his covenant when he defeats the powers of the nations and rescues his people from slavery and delivers them into a land flowing with milk and honey. He is their true God. They are his people. This rescue and the succeeding 40 years camping trip inform the rest, the whole rest of Israel's story, a story of complete dependence upon the God who had chosen them to be his people. But the Exodus also stands as the evidence against Israel when they abandoned Yahweh, the God who had brought them out of slavery, and devoted themselves instead to gods that their pagan neighbors worshipped. In that same passage that I just quoted to you from Jeremiah, Jeremiah goes on to confront the people of Jerusalem who were worshiping the gods of their neighbors. Jeremiah writes, "Therefore I will contend with you, declares the Lord, and with your children's children I will contend. Has a nation changed its gods, even though they are no gods? But my people have changed their glory for what does not profit. Be appalled, O heavens, at this. Be shocked. Be utterly desolate," declares the Lord. Tribes, nations, and empires devoted themselves to their patron gods and goddesses. Zeus had declared war on Troy on behalf of the Greeks. Apollo threw his power in behind the Trojans. But the Israelites, among all of the nations, abandoned their God, the only true God, and gave away their glory to be like the nations. The people of the Exodus would become the people of the exile. If Israel wouldn't be faithful to the covenant, then Yahweh would send them out of the land to Babylon to live in darkness among the pagan peoples. And what was the resolution to this desperate state of affairs? How could Israel hope to return from this national death sentence? only by the merciful, loving kindness of the Lord would they return to their native home. The prophet Ezekiel reassures the Jews, saying these words, "Therefore, thus says the Lord God, now I will restore the fortunes of Jacob and have mercy on the whole house of Israel, and I will be jealous for my holy name. They shall forget their shame and all the treachery that they have practiced against me when they dwell securely in their land with none to make them afraid. When I have brought them back from the peoples and gathered them from their enemies' lands, and through them vindicated my holiness in the sight of all the nations." You see, it is only by God's care and love that the Jews could come back. But notice here in Ezekiel that both the subject and the object of this second Exodus is the glory of God's holy name. The Jews would indeed return, but this result was secondary. The secondary effect of the primary goal, which was Yahweh vindicating his own name and the holiness of his own glory among all the nations of the world. Yes, God shows his faithfulness to his people, the Jews, by not leaving them to disappear among the Gentile nations, but Yahweh's greater plan, to draw all men to himself, is the object of Ezekiel's prophecy. The Jews returned home to rebuild the city and the temple, a second Exodus, but the second temple always stood empty. The prophets never recorded that Yahweh returned to live among his people. Now John, in our gospel today, remarks that Jesus took his disciples to the other side of the Sea of Galilee along with the crowds that gathered to hear him, and he went up on the mountain and sat down. And it was Passover, says John. Because they were so far away from a town where they could all buy food, Jesus took the young boys 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, blessed and broke them, and then gave them to the disciples to distribute among the people. And when they had eaten their fill, Jesus told the disciples to collect the fragments which filled 12 baskets. And there were about 5,000 men, plus women and children. And seeing what had just happened, the crowds declared, "This must be the prophet that Moses had promised would come when God remembered his people." What does John mean for us to understand as we read this most famous account again? Simply this, that Jesus is the greater Moses, whom the first Moses had promised 1,500 years before. That first Moses had brought the Hebrew tribes out of slavery to the Egyptians and had brought them into the land that he had given to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Jesus, the second and greater Moses, sits down upon the mountain as the divine lawgiver and feeds the people with manna from above, the bread of angels. But if Jesus is the new Moses, then who are the disciples and the crowds who follow Jesus in the wilderness? In the mind of John, if Jesus is the new Moses, then those who feed upon him and follow him in faith must now be new Israel. John says as much in his prologue to the gospel when he wrote about the eternal word, "He came to his own and his own people did not receive him. But to all who did receive him, who believed in his name, he gave them the right to become children of God, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God." Jesus, the Son of Mary, the Son of God, the long-expected King of Israel, came to his own people to fulfill all of Yahweh's promises to the people of Israel, the Jews, but they did not receive him. Would their faithlessness nullify the faithfulness of God to his promises to save the world? No, they would not. The great Exodus, the greatest of all Exoduses, would go forward. Jesus would lead his redeemed people forward out into the world, Jews and Gentiles alike, not out of slavery to Egypt, but out of slavery to sin, death, and Satan. He would feed them in the wilderness with his own flesh and blood. His spirit would be present with them in a column of cloud and fire. His blood shed upon the cross would be the final Passover, and his people would go free. The good news of John's gospel is that Jesus was indeed Israel's long-expected Messiah, the one who had come to unveil Yahweh's covenant faithfulness to Israel and to the whole world in the great and final Exodus. In Jesus, you see, the whole world has been set free. The church invites us today to celebrate that freedom on this, the fourth Sunday in Lent. We are past the midway point in our Lenten devotions, and the calendar tells us to rejoice. One of the many names for this Sunday is Laetare Sunday, coming from the hymn the choirs sang on this Sunday from the book of the prophet Isaiah, "Rejoice, O Jerusalem." And we are glad, not just that we can see Easter just around the corner, but that we can see what great things the Lord has done for us. The epistle from Paul's letter to the Galatians gives us another name for this Sunday, Mothering Sunday. Now, this shouldn't be confused with Mother's Day, which was established here in the United States by President Woodrow Wilson as a holiday on the second Sunday of May. No, Mothering Sunday was always the fourth Sunday in Lent, when we hear Paul's words to the Galatians, "Now Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia, and she corresponds to the present Jerusalem, for she is in slavery with her children. But the Jerusalem above is free, and she is our mother. For it is written, 'Rejoice, O barren one who does not bear. Break forth and cry aloud, you who are not in labor, for the children of the desolate one will be more than those of the one who has a husband.' Now you, brothers," says Paul, "now you, brothers, like Isaac, are children of the promise." Paul, interpreting the story of Abraham as an allegory, says that Abraham's two wives reveal a deeper truth. Hagar, the Egyptian concubine, bore a son for Abraham, but he was a slave. But Sarah, the wife of promise, bore him a son who is free. In the same way, says Paul, we who have believed in Jesus are no longer slaves to Torah, as the Jews who reject Jesus the Messiah are. We are children of the heavenly Jerusalem. She is our mother. This is Mothering Sunday. We have all been set free from bondage. What better news can we share with our neighbors, my friends, with one another in the world? We've been set free from the powers of this world to serve the living God. There is nothing that can separate us from the love of God, that now we have been welcomed in where once we were strangers, that we are on a pilgrimage, but we do not walk alone. Instead, like the Israelites in the first Exodus, we are surrounded by the Spirit of God, and he feeds and cares for us all along the way. The great temptation is that we don't enjoy camping with the saints, and instead we attempt to make a home here in the midst of the comforts of this world. We are tempted daily to compromise with the powers of this world, to be accepted, to be powerful, to be secure. But Jesus calls us to the glory that awaits, that exceeds all of our hopes and dreams, like the light of the sun exceeds the light of the candles upon the altar here. We have been set free by the power of Jesus upon the cross, rising from the grave on the third day. He has defeated the powers that stood against us, the law, the power of death, the power of sin, the power of Satan. They have all been defeated. We have been set free. Amen.